Good morning, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Hawk Blogger Mornings. I am Brian Nemhauser. You can find us and all that we do at TikTok, Instagram, YouTube, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, at Hawk Blogger. And when it's Friday during the season, it's a Blue Friday. That means we get Mike Sando with us. And on a very special occasion, we bring in our friend Dave Bowling as well. And this is a special occasion as the Seahawks have secured the number one seed, a bye week. And fellas, first of all, good morning. How are you doing, Dave?
Doing great.
And Mike, how's your Friday getting going?
Friday's great. Dave and I actually spent some time together yesterday. We went and visited a great friend of ours who had a successful bone marrow transplant. So Joe, Tip of the cap to you. Hope you're having a good day today. And it was great to get together. Somebody we'd worked with, 30 plus years ago. So
one of the guys that make journalism an integrous profession.
Yeah. Say more.
That you see, the guys with the bylines and the mugshots, behind them are the people who give the orders and decide what gets covered and are really the heart and soul of a sports staff and a newspaper staff.
Yeah. I'm sorry. I'm distracted right now because I see my wife driving away with her trunk wide open.
Oh my gosh.
She just got out, closed it.
She'll find out. Yeah.
I mean, I was about like, do I need to go out there and wave her down?
Go ahead. We'll continue.
Our dog,
you guys are telling this man got in the story about integrity.
I said our dog ran and got in the FedEx truck during this holiday season.
Really?
Yeah. I took him out to meet, he's always barking at these guys, and gals who come and deliver, but he's friendly. So I take him out there to meet them. A lot of them bring treats. They love the dogs. They don't want one jumping all over them, but I kept him under wraps. I took him off the leash because it was, and I had him by the collar, but I said, hey, you can meet him. And so petting, and I let him and he just took and ran and got right in the truck. FedEx truck, got in, was sniffing packages, whatever.
He could be a bomb sniffer,
bomb sniffing dog, whatever.
There's some
I'd go in there and get him.
I wouldn't mind Finn taking a trip on a FedEx bus or car somewhere, truck somewhere. Well, I'm glad to hear that you guys spent some time together and for a good reason. And we'll talk about the Seahawks, we'll talk about the playoffs, all that stuff. But I always love hearing stories from you guys, and it seems like a good time to get a little reflective and nostalgic. It's not often the Seahawks have a number one overall seed. It's not often that they're in this position where they have home playoff games. You guys covered the team when they first got in this position. What do you remember from that year as they embarked on their first time in this situation?
Go for it, Dave.
Yeah, Dave, go ahead.
So you're specifically looking for 05 type?
I mean, anything that stands out to you.
Okay,
but
here, yeah. Just maybe something that the fans can relate to. You love the game. You get invested. Even as writers, you get invested with the players because you spend time with them. You appreciate people who help you do your job. And you see a lot more than the typical fan sees what these guys look like on a Tuesday or a Monday after a game. And you really understand the pain that they deal with and the process of dealing with that and going through the trainer and guys hobbling back to their locker. And you really get to understand how much effort they put into this. And so you do develop a little emotional equity with some of the guys who've been hurt and they're playing hard, and to see them get this kind of reward, you do kind of get excited. Okay, you love to see excellence and people doing their job great. That's the beauty. That's what draws. You may go to a game and you'll see the Beastquake or, some of those sorts of things. It may be historic. Every time you go to a game, you may see something you've never seen before. And to see a team play at this level, as those earlier Super Bowl number one seed teams do, it's joyful to see people excel. And you know the work they put into it. And to see that translate into a winning product, I get worked up. I get goosebumps talking about it. And that's what every one of those teams had. and all the guys, and I kind of think about those guys, you know, as I look back at the great teams they've had.
Yep. I think of, so for that year, I think of, they started 2-2, number one, start off, they lose out of the gates, I believe, at Jacksonville. And then there was a game at Washington where, you know, Holmgren came under some fire because of the, you know, play calling, when he ran the ball, I think, and settled for a long field goal that went off the upright. So you're 2-2. You had this team, remember, the year before that had lost three times to the Rams. And one of those games was very much the reverse of this Seattle comeback. They were ahead by 17 points with 5 minutes left and lost the game. So you came into the season with hope. They finished 9-7, but they had lost in the playoffs to the Rams three in a row. You needed to get sort of over the hump, and you're 2-2 out of the gates. And so you're not sure you're going to get over the hump. In retrospect, yeah, it was a great team. They had a great season, but it was a process throughout the year. And I can remember you sort of got into maybe November, December. I think they played the Eagles and won like 40-0 or something. You had a couple of games there. I think they blew out the 49ers, same sort of thing, like 41-3. There's kind of an arrival point where you've won a bunch of games in a row, and then you have some huge blowouts, you know. So you really do arrive. But when you get to the playoffs, you're still not sure because they haven't done it. And the thing I remember there was, and I think we're going to see this again this year, that stadium, when it's in the playoffs, they haven't had a playoff game there with a good team that was, and you know, they had a COVID playoff game. They really haven't had a playoff game with a good team in that stadium for a long time. And It is different. And Mike McDonald doesn't know what it's like. These guys do not know what it's like. It's going to be unbelievable, that atmosphere. And I think that championship game against Carolina was epic for that. And it was already a well-established venue where the Giants had jumped off sides, you know, 10 times or something, false started. Mm-hmm. But that was like another level. And I think that's kind of the beauty of these games. When your fan base knows you're good, this is a different place. So I think that's what we're going to see in these playoffs, is just, it's going to be unbelievable atmosphere.
There will never be another game that like that first NFC championship game. Yeah. And I've been to pretty much every game since 97 here, and all the different places. That one stands apart. It was impossible. No team would have won coming in that day. It was just impossible. Sorry, Dave, you're about to say something.
No, I just, as I look back at that team and I think about it, it's a little different than the subsequent three teams that have had the level of success. I feel, because that was an offensive, the strength of that team was the offense. Yeah. And it was very much Holmgren's personality. And in a way, you know, there was a revival for him, really, you know, that he had hit some hard times here. And he had been, you know, the king of the hill when they brought him in here. And this really was kind of the Holmgren, I won't say redemption because he didn't have a failure really, but this was him being elevated back to the level that ownership had and fans had hoped. And they had the veterans on and the all pros on offense, and the defense was young guys. And so that's what brought that hint of the unknown really to that team. You know, Lofa, was he a rookie then, or?
Lofa was a rookie.
Yeah. Lofa. Marcus Tubbs was a rookie. Yeah.
And really, Tubby.
I think the way that it ended for Tim Ruskell, you know, was as the GM, was obviously people were fed up with him and he kind of went out on a bad note. But that first year, I think, in bringing in some guys like Lofa Tutupu, Chuck Darby, you know, just an all-time favorite.
Yeah.
Really some glue guys, because they were kind of a team on defense that just lacked cohesiveness, a communication, a confidence. And I think some of those guys that came in and that had won before, I think that he signed Joe Jurevicius on the offensive side. But they're just some nice glue pieces that are not going to be on anyone's Hall of Fame placard that we signed these guys, but they were super really good additions to the team that the team needed, that the team wouldn't have gotten without. They made a GM change going into that year. You know, I think it was just a lot of things came together. And even for Holmgren, yeah, he got back, but he did it with the run game. And Mike Holmgren, you know, I don't think, I didn't even realize this, but, you know, he had 5 MVP quarterback seasons as a play caller. Mm-hmm. But the only two were that Joe Montana had were after Bill Walsh left and Holmgren was the OC. And then he had three of them with Favre. So he's definitely known for the pass and the passing game, and rightfully so, but really leaned into the run game that year, you know, with mm-hmm. Sean Alexander, the offensive line. I thought it was just a great job by everybody of kind of putting together a team and kind of being cohesive, more cohesive than they'd been. Because if you go back to Holmgren's earlier tenure, it really wasn't what they thought it was going to be in terms of Bob Witsit that was still there. And it was a little, it was not exactly Camelot there in those early years. And it wasn't at the end either, but I feel like that moment, everything was aligned enough with the talent, the leadership, the people they brought in to get a season that just is a one-off, really, that you just don't have unless you're, you know, lucky enough to be in one of those 49er dynasties or Patriot dynasties.
You know what I don't think, I still don't think Mike Holmgren gets enough credit for, and I think you guys have obviously observed this, is the Seahawks franchise was a proud but largely middling franchise before he got there. Through its history, Chuck Knox obviously had some high highs, but generally it was a pretty mediocre franchise. And what it takes to transition from a franchise, like to build an actual championship franchise from the middle, is so rare. And you just felt his presence was the reason that happened. And frankly, guys, it's never, I mean, it's waned, waxed and waned, but it's been a championship franchise since then. And literally the most NFC West division titles, the highest win percentage in the NFC West since that realignment, the most Super Bowl wins, or at least tied for that. Like, they've been a franchise that's done that. So I think Mike Holmgren deserves a ton.
Yeah, and don't forget that they got Holmgren because Paul Allen took over the team. And I think that's a great component 100%. Of this thing too, because, you know, I was covering the team, obviously Dave was, when they hired Holmgren, and we couldn't believe it. It was just like, my gosh, the Seahawks got Mike Holmgren. I mean, Mike Holmgren had his choice. He was one of those guys who could go anywhere, you know? And it was rumored that he was looking for a GM job and stuff. He wasn't just going to go to a crap place, though. It was mid here, but Paul taking over the team, I think, enabled that too. And it's been his ownership, and now through Jody, that has been a big part of this too. It's really hard to overcome, not great ownership. And the CX have had good ownership over the years. The Nordstroms were good owners, but Paul really took it to another level too.
When Mike arrived, the one thing there were so many things that changed. First class, this guy knows how to win. He allowed that persona to show. He was not about to, they call him the big show. I think he enjoyed that. And training camp, you know, he'd been used to what was going on and how they did it. You show up at Eastern Washington, and on the side of one of the buildings there is a banner with Holmgren's visage.
This thing was huge.
That looked like Joseph Stalin in
Mussolini, you know? Yeah.
It was.
It's slightly more power than those guys, Dave.
And then all of a sudden it's like, okay, you have your identity here. You know, you don't know whether you need to bow at it or whatever. He came in and everybody knew he was the boss. The thing about the 05 team that just struck me, and maybe we would get back to this, I don't know. I use this to kind of judge where this year's Super Bowl team, let's call this year a potential Super Bowl team. We're talking about the number one seeds. Uh-huh. Okay. When they got to that game against the Steelers, in retrospect, I kind of quibble about the game plan. You know, they're going to throw it to Jeremy Stephens and he dropped four passes or what, you know, the specifics that the game plan didn't seem to adapt. It wasn't working and it didn't seem to adapt. But the other thing was the way the roster was built. Mike wanted to spend the money on offense and be young on defense, but they were also thin on defense. And you look at the injuries in the secondary. and you end up going into the Super Bowl, the biggest game in franchise history. Again, Ettrick Pruitt. Remember, you're down to a guy.
Yes.
Marquand Manuel came in.
Yeah.
They had some injuries. But you end up in the Super Bowl with guys who are practice squad or really far down. And when in a game when 2, 3, 4 plays make the difference, I think that killed them. Now, with this team, I think this is, I'm writing about this for Sunday. I think this is a real organizational victory and roster building skills. You see the guys that they've had come in. You've got 3 guys Pro Bowl. You have probably another 2 or 3 or maybe even 4 who have played at Pro Bowl level, you know, with Murphy and some of Love. And then you have guys who have come in off practice squad. You look at Drake Thomas, Ty Okada, Josh Jobe to some extent, guys who were undrafted guys. I think Okada's been up and down practice squad 9 times. These guys, Nehemiah Pritchett, these guys have all made, during the course of the year when they've been asked to jump in, have made plays, striking plays, that were, if you look at that play alone, it was a Pro Bowl quality effort. Out of Pritchett looking, knocking that pass away from Marvin Harrison in the end zone. This is a guy who is a fill-in guy.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a Pro Bowl quality play. Okada, a number of times. Jobe leads the team, or is tied for the lead in pass defenses.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, these are depth chart guys. And this is what John and Pete wanted from the start when they had that 300 turnover transactions the first year. If you can improve number 70, you've improved the team.
Yeah.
And it pays off.
The 05 team ran out of those guys, Dave, because remember Jordan Babineau had that great interception off Bledsoe late in the game against Dallas, and they got the last second field goal to win. You have teams that succeed like this, that have this type of record. You have guys like that. I think that team ran out of those guys in the last game.
Yep.
And this team seems to just find new ones. And
that's a triumph of roster building.
Yeah, not only roster building, but I also think that this staff has shown this is a little overboard, but this staff could be a little bit more like the early Holmgren ones in Green Bay. And I'm not saying they're going to have 10 head coaches like that, but I mean, I feel like player after player has developed here. Mm-hmm. Guys who you would have thought early in the year, the Ty Okadas, you would have thought, God, they got to find an answer here. They're going to be exposed if this guy's on the field too long. Then he becomes I feel like they've got 5 Jordan Babineaus. Do you feel like that?
You know, and the other thing, I think, I don't know if it's been up and down 9 times. I mean, this is an investment. Some of those guys have been there since 23.
Yeah.
And now, So they're building equity. They understand. So that now you're not just trying to replace the 70th guy with talent. Now you've got guys who have experience in the program as well. And that's more of a long-term building that you kind of don't see when you just look at who the starters are.
I think that's a great point, Dave and Mike. And it's not for Mike McDonald, it's not specific to here. It's something that also happened in Baltimore. I mean, I used like Geno Stone as an example back then. And there's a number of guys that had career years and then they went elsewhere and they weren't that good. And so there is a little bit of pixie dust in his pocket. And, part of the reason I was talking about the Holmgren thing was there is, like, people talk about the teams and the talents and the rosters. But I've always felt like there's this sense of inertia with an organization, right? With the franchise and where it's going. And in the case of Holmgren, you could feel a tectonic shift going on. Even if it took a little while, you got there. And then with Pete Carroll, you felt that was like very different than when like Jim Mora Jr. took over. And then with Mike McDonald, as much as Pete Carroll had not cratered in terms of winning, the defense certainly had. And to go from one of the worst defenses in the NFL to one of the best defenses in franchise history.
Unbelievable.
In 2 years, feels like an absolutely remarkable accomplishment.
The other thing is, you know, we've been seeing this thing with like their last however many first and second round draft picks. That's a being on the same page with coaching too.
Yes.
That's like getting like, this isn't just John Schneider now. I mean, some of it, the organization has gotten back to drafting a different way like they did early on, but that is also part of a partnership and a development plan and competency sort of a thing. So much of success of players is where you go. And that's what you're talking about, Brian, where guys go different places and then they suck or whatever, right? Or Sam Darnold's somewhere and he looks like he's can't play. I think it is a very big organizational thing. And that's why, like, not to get too off topic, but like when a John Harbaugh goes away from the Ravens, I can't wait to see if it's totally different for him, because he's a great coach, but like he's part of this organization that had Ozzie Newsome and then his successor, Eric DaCosta, and they've had two coaches for 25 years and they just sort of know what they're doing. How much of it, you know, these pieces have to be together sometimes to get the, none of them could do it on their own. John Schneider was here through those years when the defense wasn't good.
Yep.
But he didn't just learn how to do it again, right? It's all how all these things come together, fit.
And bringing the right guys, the fit is the thing. Seeing that Leonard Williams, DeMarcus Lawrence are the old guys, but they're not broken down. And those two are playing. What I love this defense particularly, what are the balloons?
it's your fingers. It's reading your gestures.
I'll sit on my hands. Those two guys are playing like undrafted rookies. They're playing with that kind of energy.
Yes.
It's like a rejuvenation. Those guys they've become leaders. And so that the young guys who would normally have that kind of energy, Drake Thomas and Okada, let's say, are playing with a veteran savvy.
Yes.
And so what that creates, as Leonard said, effort erases mistakes.
It does. Yeah. He did.
And I think that's a really good point to make. And you look at what Williams and Lawrence are doing on that defensive line. It's a joyful thing. I mean,
yeah.
DeMarcus is doing some of those Reggie White arm slaps and knocking people out of the way. And the big cat is just playing like a panther.
Yeah.
And when you get the veterans playing with rookies fervor and the young guys playing with the veteran savvy, that's a real special combination they've got going right now.
The poetry of Dave Bowling, great as usual. Hey,
give me some balloons.
Brian, very gracious of you to, you know, Dave, those balloons go up when you fart, so just try to hold them. Very gracious of you, Brian, to, you know, give him an outfit.
I didn't want to say that, but you're right.
Shared a lot
of
rental cars and airplanes with this guy. No.
Come on.
I'm kidding.
You got a nerve.
I say this over the computer. I'm very tough over the computer. I've never said that to Dave's face. So.
Dave, I've had a bad influence on Mike. I've you know, shown like not the highest journalistic integrity, and so I've taken him down a notch. It's okay. But you mentioned Mike. We're talking to Mike Sando of The Athletic, Dave Bowling, who writes for the Spokesman Review, among other places. You talked about the draft history, and like everyone got excited about the Gray Zabel, Nicky Minwori, Byron Murphy, you know, Devin Witherspoon, JSN, all those guys that they've drafted since 2022.
Yeah.
Right.
Uh-huh.
But here is how stark of a contrast it is. I'm going to read from 2021, like going backwards for a little bit. Their first pick, 2021, D. Eskridge. Their first two picks in 2020, Jordan Brooks, not bad. Daryl Taylor, not great. 2019, LJ Collier and Marquise Blair. 2018, Rashad Penny, Rasheem Green. 2017, Malik McDowell. It's been like a pretty significant shift where it used to be the rule that either the Seahawks and John Schneider were going to trade their first round pick or for probably a too expensive of a veteran that wasn't going to be worth it, or they were going to reach for somebody or for some position that didn't make sense. So they've now gone to actually chalk, like picking the kind of the people you'd expect them to pick. It's not some remarkable philosophy, but John said, I was pushing need too high in the evaluation. And it's very clear they've stopped doing that.
But that's what happens when you get to the mountaintop. You think you're close and you're looking for pieces and you're picking late, which, and so you do things. You have a head coach who's very empowered, and John Schneider wants nothing more than to like make the coach happy. Like Pete's won. He's got this whole culture and he's like, hey, I believe a lot of times what happens is we need, you know what they took, it was McDowell or whoever, some of these, there's a couple of years where they really needed a pass rusher and they took one instead of having the patience. So they took one with a shorter view of like, let's plug this guy in. This is what we need. And I think that is where you get into trouble. And so if they have, obviously they're the number one seed now, if they have a nice sustained run of success, that's where the discipline has to come in. To keep going with younger and developing guys and that sort of a thing. And I have some pretty good faith that they're going to do that this time. I think some of that with Pete was, also a coach who'd been there before too, you know, and you get super empowered, I think, sometimes to add some of these guys. And I think they're a little bit more of a balance right now in terms of the decision-making. Would you agree with that?
I would. And I think that Mike McDonald has come in very deferential in that regard, but not passive. Like it was Mike McDonald that went to the Senior Bowl in Mobile, Alabama and gave a report on every part of the roster to the personnel department about where things were. And it was very honest. Like that's participatory. He goes to the combine when Sean McVay and Kyle Shanahan do not go to the combine. Like a lot of coaches don't anymore. So he is participating, but he also understands, like he it's just at his core, he's humble.
And when you say humble, think of John Schneider. I've read a lot of, there's been a lot of stories done about John Schneider lately. Like he's hardly quoted in them or he isn't at all. Hasn't he noticed that? You don't see stories like we had one, you did a great one. And then Michael Sean Dugar had one for us that was really good. I mean, we were quoting Nolan Teasley and Trent Kirsch and all these guys. I couldn't find one for John. Isn't that interesting? He's not out front. I think he's never out front with this stuff. Like he's never out taking credit for it. I always get the feeling you got to twist his arm to talk at the combine publicly, to talk to for the record and that sort of a thing, or it's just not him.
Can I tell you a quick story on that? Just one sec, Dave, and I'll let you in. So before the 49ers game, I ran into John before they were heading out to the team buses. And he came over and we were just chatting and I was like, I hope you recognize and give yourself some credit for like the culture that you guys have been able to cultivate, since you've taken over. And he just kind of shook his head and he was like, it's always been there. Like I didn't do that. And that's his, it's not false modesty. I think that's his perspective, but I was like, look, I've seen large organizational change at the leadership level.
Yeah.
It is hard. It is hard to maintain or to grow a positive culture. And he deserves a ton of credit for the choices that are very intentional about who he's brought in and how he's led. So I agree. I think he deserves a ton of credit. Sorry, Dave, go ahead.
No, I think there's over time, as Mike was saying, you get involved in the power and you create your own identity and who you want. You remember Tim Ruskell wanted the Eagle Scout guys, the guys who were, straight shooters and high grade point average and character guys. And sometimes they weren't the best football players. And I think Pete, he got that goal of getting gritty guys. And that's terrific. Guys who've been through things. Almost everybody who was a high draft pick had gone through something, you know, in their life. And it's a cool thing, and it made great stories. I think you can get kind of too attached to that kind of thing sometimes. And you think, oh, this guy, and in the long run, yeah, he's going to stay hungry maybe. And you got that guy's with the inner strength. That's great.
Hey.
Got to play.
Yeah, and Tim brought those guys in when they needed it. They'd had Jeremy Stevens and Corn Robinson and some of those swings that worked, so it really needed it. It ended up being something that went too far and the roster fell off later.
Maybe that's what I was thinking, was hitting that skid where you started looking at other qualities on the scale when you're evaluating.
Yeah, yeah, and I love the types of players that I think these two guys want to have. You know, it's rare to have the differentiating young defensive coach like this, who's not all just the culture guy, right? He's he's doing the scheme too. So I think they're really well set up to make use of their talent. I just got to say, we were talking about the 05 team. And I just wanted to share something. I was just looking at a couple of things here. That team was so offensive line driven that when you look, their leading receivers that year were Bobby Engram with 774 yards and 3 touchdowns, Drew Avicius 694, Stevens 554. No one else, Daryl Jackson 480, DJ Hackett 400, Peter Warwick 180. That's their receivers. Okay, here's their sack leaders. Bryce Fisher, 9, Rocky Bernard, 8.5, Leroy Hill, 7.5, Tubbs, 5.5, Wistrom, Lofa, Chuck Darby. Think how different these teams are configured.
Mm-hmm.
That team was so offensive line. They had the greatest offensive line maybe in the history of the league, or certainly one of them. But you lean into your strengths. You kind of become, you know that. I think what's interesting about this team is it takes a long time to build an offensive line. It's almost impossible to do now, but like, they've built arguably the best defensive front in the game pretty quickly. And there are some great players on there, but I don't think it's like they were household. You know what I mean? They're like better than their parts too. Would you agree?
Yeah, for sure. And I think what's remarkable about that is that the trenches were probably the weakest part of this team 3 years ago.
Yeah.
And they first started with the defensive line. The trade for Leonard Williams was obviously foundational. And they tried with signing Draymond Jones and spending all that money, but didn't really work out. But they were very intentional about getting after the trenches, and it's paid off. But related to, like, before I lose the thought, you guys were talking about the Tim Ruskell and the kind of the character guys that they started drafting, right? Well, so when I was talking to Nolan Teasley, who's the assistant general manager, I was kind of interested because the Seahawks, Mike McDonald and John Schneider, had talked about drafting high character guys. And I was like, I've seen that before, and it gets overemphasized, and then you get low talent, low ceiling, good guys, but they're not going to make a difference. But what they're talking about is different than what I think Tim Ruskell, and this is what Nolan said. Like, it's like, that was about who the person was off the field to some extent. What they're looking for is high football character, people that play the game the way that they want to see it played. And that is this nuance that I think is really critical to understanding how they're locking in on these guys that just live, eat, sleep the game.
You don't want you want violent players who aren't violent people. Does that make sense?
Yeah. It's hard. It's a hard balance to strike.
Yeah.
Yeah. Leonard Williams leads the league in, didn't he lead the league in unsportsmanlike or an unnecessary roughness? And you look at the coaching of this team. The opponents run a play. You don't see gaps unfilled.
Yes.
You don't see coverages blown. This year, their penalties, they've had 20% fewer penalties this year. DPI, fourth fewest in the NFL. 6 DPIs all season. You look at the 13 team had 15 DPIs. Now you want guys playing hard, but boy, all those yards, you think of the, and especially on a penalty like that, that is so punitive.
Yes.
It might be a 60 yard penalty.
Yeah.
To have only six, especially when you've got all the, you know, the manpower shuffling, is so well coached. There's so much discipline. The offensive holding way down. They just play smarter.
And that happened with Holmgren too. When Holmgren came in, they suddenly became one of the least penalized teams in the league, and they'd always been one of the heaviest. Sean McVay's teams lead the league in fewest pre-snap penalties, right? There can be a pattern to some of this. Like, are you running a tight ship? Is that kind of what you mean, Dave?
It's an indicator of discipline, yeah. I think, and understanding. You know, didn't Lawrence say this was my getting into my Harvard playbook here? You know, that looking at McDonald's playbook really took him a while, but it works. The group is so, you used to see somebody running free and you go, what happened? Where'd that guy come from? Or gap integrity breaking down. That's discipline. That's going to practice. That's working on these things so that when somebody comes in as a substitute, they know where they're going. They're not making dumb mistakes. They say, oh yeah, he probably didn't understand what his responsibilities were. And that is kudos, flowers due to staff-wide coaching.
I've got a couple of questions for you guys that I want to get to. There's another thing I want to kind of bring up that is percolating in my brain, and it's related to this, which is, it's not just about the players, right? It's about the coaches and the coaches being held to a standard. And, you know, year one, Mike McDonald moves on from his OC and his line coach and goes out there, deliberate search. The guy he hires now is a very popular candidate to potentially become a head coach. I also think that Kennedy Polamalu, I think this is a little bit of a quiet one. Okay. I think that was more of a mutual decision to kind of like part ways. I don't know all the details. I'm speculating to some extent, so not an official report. But Justin Outen, who is the run game coordinator and also part of the offensive line, you know, coaching staff, takes over the running back room. That was before the Colts game, and the Colts game was bad on a number of levels. But every game since then, tell me you don't see a running back room that is more decisive in hitting their holes, that there's less dancing around, that the running game has absolutely taken off. And I'm bringing this up because I think there's a potential that Mike McDonald again said, hey, we're having a problem and it's not being coached the way we want, and makes a change. They did that with personnel last year. They did that with coaching with Grubb last year. And I think that's a really rare thing, to be willing to make those kind of changes, you know, in the middle of all this.
I cannot wait to hear Dave's thoughts on this. I'll tee it up this way, because Dave really watches the run game and the blocking. He's always got binoculars on the offensive line, you know, and obviously played offensive line when he was in college. But one of the things that they have done, and I've just looked at some of the data on this, is over that period, they have condensed their core number of sort of run schemes that they're using. They've kind of, simplifying might be one way to say it, but just they've gotten a little more coherent in their run game and the run concepts that they've been using. I think they've pared that down a little bit. And so I think that's probably some of this. But Dave, what do you see?
I think it's an interesting point that Brian brings up that I hadn't considered with the staffing change. We see a different philosophy in the fact that they came out and said, Kenneth Walker's our guy. Now, obviously, they're going to be sharing. And I love that they use both those guys in different ways. It really adds to the value of this team. Maybe just by creating your identity. He's our guy. Coming out and saying something like that is not what you usually see from a staff. It's obviously a message was being sent. And Walker's performance, you know, plant the foot in the ground and head uphill. And he is, as you know, I've been a big fan of his talents. And I think we're really seeing them. And Gray Zabel, all in love with that guy. You know, with Sundell since he's been back. Now, what those two guys can do, and we didn't get a chance to see this talent, they can get out and run.
Yes.
Really with top quality offensive linemen, and especially to see a center who can get out and run like that is warms my heart. And so what that has done, how do they display this? They have expanded the screen game. I don't know the numbers.
You're 100% right.
I'm just telling you, I see that was something that was never used. What does that do? It exploits the talents of guys like that. Cross is just a natural. And those two guys coming around have skills to get out. And that one Zabel block, and it wasn't a screen, I don't believe, up the left sideline with leading Walker for 40 yards or whatever it was. Spectacular. Love watching that. It was like the old days when they used to sew a suitcase handle on the back of a guard and the running back could just hold on to it, follow it up. It was.
They did that, Dave?
Supposedly.
Okay. You were not around back then. You're too young.
No, in the leather helmet days. Yeah.
But I'm serious. That's amazing.
What you're seeing and what that does is create space, green grass for Kenneth Walker and Zach Charbonnet, where they don't have to create it from the middle of the line. So you're not dealing with any issues there and getting shoved back. That disrupts every running play. Now, they may make a nice cut and a cut back and whatever, but to get them where they can be at full speed and have green grass in front of them, and you can't do that. And the other thing is having receivers who are willing and capable to block. And you see Bobo and JSN, those guys down there really doing a great job, and that's another huge thing. Now, you're having to defend 53 yards wide. And that really opens everything up for the slashing game inside.
What do you think of what effect, Dave? Sorry, Brian, I'm taking over.
Please.
I'm just curious. With Charles Cross coming back, they obviously just gave him a nice contract. What's different is in the run game or anything like that? What does he give to the team that they don't have?
He's just really good. And in all phases, he's just really good. And he's getting better. And that's what I'm thinking about. Pretty much across the line. Zabel had maybe he was banged up. I don't know. He kind of hit a low spot where it looked like he wasn't.
He talked about the rookie wall.
Be as impactful, yeah. And to see the last couple of games, he has been spectacular.
I think you can. A great point about the screen game, and that's another coaching feather in the cap, because Mike McDonald, he was so proud when, I think it was Curtis Crabtree, asked him about the screen game. He just got this big Cheshire Cat grin. He's like, thanks for asking. Yeah, we decided we wanted to get better at it. We've been practicing it, and now we're better at it. And you guys remember...
You can't do it without linemen who can move.
You can't. You guys remember the John L. Williams screen game, the way back in the 80s and 90s. It was a lethal part of that offense. And as a fan, I feel like I haven't seen a credible screen game since. Like, I've seen some years where it's at least passable, but like it's a weapon for this team. And so one of the things I kind of called this a reverse metamorphosis from the explosive passing butterfly that they were to the ground game and screen game team over the last few, weeks. They're literally a top 10 rushing team since week 10. They're a top 3 rushing team over the last 3 weeks. As you guys think about what you've seen, all the playoff football you've seen, do you think that this offense, for all the fact that it's not as explosive in some ways as it was, do you think it's better prepared to play the playoff football that you might need to win in these games coming up?
Built for this. It's built for this time of year. everything is coming together. And I laughed at McDonald after the game. He says, it's everything we've worked for from the moment we walked in the building is coming to life. And I thought, he's like the scene in Dr. Frankenstein. It's alive! It's alive!
Yeah.
He had pieced this together, and he's found that spark. It's everything that he was looking for. And that was the first thing he had to say. I'm proud of these guys, and this is coming to life. This is the physical manifestation of the vision he had, and it's really red hot and rolling.
All right, Mike, I got to ask you, as you look ahead to the playoff weekend that's ahead, wild card weekend.
Sure.
What are the storylines that have kind of your attention going into what will be your pick six column?
Yeah, so some interesting things to me are, we have 8 head coach openings, right? So during the year, and just talking to people in front offices, one of the questions we would ask is like, okay, between Baltimore, Pittsburgh, and Buffalo, do all three head coaches come back, or is one gone? And we agreed one would be gone. So Harbaugh's already gone. There's been some rumblings with Matt LaFleur's contract with the Packers. Mm. There's always sort of like, hey, is there pressure on the Bills? What's going on with Sean McDermott? And then Mike Tomlin's future. So I think just in this wild card round with John Harbaugh available and kind of saying, I'm not going to do any interviews till next week. Is he waiting, right? Are we going to see one of these kind of open that we're not really talking about because we're focused on the game? So that's one, the coaching thing.
Can I pause you before you go to your next?
Yep.
Clint Kubiak, obviously, has got a lot of interest. What's your read right now on whether he's a real candidate or just a guy that people are kicking the tires on?
Well, no, I think he's a real candidate. And when you have this many openings, and maybe there's going to be one more. If you have 9 openings, I mean, you have a much better chance of getting one of the jobs. I think that he is not if I had to bet, I would bet that he comes back, because I think he's also he's a super grinder who loves what he's doing and isn't driven by just becoming a head coach. Right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I think he was the type of guy who would be selective in where he would go. Would not just take any job that was offered. Probably just, he's one of these guys who kind of, would be more apt to sleep in the office, than some of the other guys. And I think he just loves it. So I think he's motivated by some different things and wouldn't just take anything. But I do think he'll be a real candidate who won't go in places and just wow them with, his presence or command. But I think for the right team, the right fit, he could have appeal. I think so. I think there could be a spot for him. So I don't think they're going to lose him this year, but I think he will get legitimate looks.
Okay. I interrupted you. Continue. Yep, so the coaching was one. So
then the other interesting things to me are, I love the Buffalo Jacksonville game, just where you have the new up and comer team that seems to have a lot of good things going for him. Quarterback's playing well. Defense looks really good. And then you've got the team that, are they on their last legs or where are they? The Bills just kind of, they've taken a lot of hard shots in the playoffs before, but they're dangerous. So I really want to see, hey, is Buffalo going to maybe make a run this year, or is this kind of it for this iteration of the team? And they just go out quietly in the first round and have some real questions. I think that's
it. Is unbelievable that Josh Allen finally doesn't have Patrick Mahomes, Lamar Jackson, Joe Burrow to go through. And it's still like they finally, they might not have the team capable. It's just, I feel for the Buffalo fans.
And here's the thing. If they do and get there, I think they lose to a Seattle.
I do too.
You know what I mean? I think the AFC is probably going to lose the Super Bowl this year. So wouldn't it be something if the Bills got there and then the Bills just lose? If you're a Bills fan and have lost 4 of them, would you take a Super Bowl loss right now? Or would you rather just not?
I think they would.
They would. Okay.
Yeah.
So that's the second thing. And then I think the third thing for me is Philadelphia. I mean, just a team that Super Bowl last year, we've written them off. They're 11-6, which is a good record for most teams. We just don't feel like the vibe is there. The offense has been an issue. The coordinator's been sort of called out. No one really seems that happy. But we're reading stuff about Nick Sirianni and how he's, tried to pattern things after Steve Kerr and learning to appreciate joy. And you kind of, from afar, don't believe it. You're like, oh, this guy's kind of goofy. He's always yelling at the fans. they just sort of feel like a team that we're not talking about that, you know, could very well be playing in the championship game at Seattle.
All right. Well, I know you got to run in a little bit, Mr. Sando. Mr. Bowling, what's on your mind as the weekend kicks off? What's got your attention?
Oh, let's see. I wrote about McDonald today, and Sunday I'm doing kind of a thing on Schneider, and this being a franchise and organizational victory, where they are now, how they built, going back, looking at Schneider from the start. I was one who question this young guy, you know, obviously Pete's in charge. That I thought, well, John is, he's probably, you know, a sock puppet. And you almost couldn't see Pete's lips moving when John was making comments, you know, snarky, you know, being stupid. And at one point in that interview, when they brought him in, I remember Hugh Millen said, John, now, you know, when, with the Packers, tell us what one or two of your victories were, you know, where you identified a player who came in, you know, so we can get a little bit of your, you know, your talents and things you've accomplished. And John, it was still a young guy, and it was people, you know, that's a pressure-packed situation sitting next to your boss. And John said, we don't do that, brother. We make a decision. Everybody is on that decision. We don't, you know, you don't take victory laps for individual achievements. And I thought that moment, okay, that's interesting. That tells us a little about who this guy is. And you talk about an absence of ego. You don't hear a lot of comments out of him. It's been that way from the very first day. And I think I'm going to go back and look at some of those and how it's developed.
I love it.
And how hard it would have been to be in that building and basically be part of the discussion. Pete needs to go.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I can't wait to read that. I can't wait to read that. And guys, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you for sticking out longer than your typical time. It's a special time. And, you know, I think we'll, if it's good with you guys, we'll try to have this through the playoffs, you know, having a group chat about history and present and future. I can't imagine a better crew to do it with. So
anytime, Brian, and I know I speak for Dave, if you ever want to do a one-off or sometime, or, you know, get the band together after the day after a game or whatever, you know, we're around. So we love doing it. We love what you do. We love, you know, you got Hasselbeck on here, one of our favorite guys to ever cover. So
it's been great. I have to listen to Matt when I'm walking. I do the podcast while I'm doing my laps. It's especially with him.
I've heard feedback too. I've actually heard feedback from people in the organization I saw you on, you know, with Brian or whatever, you know, that, I think that's pretty cool stuff.
And the thing with Matt, what everybody sees with Matt is for a columnist, you could go in and you'd stand by his locker and in 10 minutes, you'd have five different really good topics fleshed out with insight and humor. And he was just such a joy. What a font. And that's coming across I don't know how you got him to do this, but.
He's a generous spirit. I give him all the credit.
But he's so good at it.
Funniest guy, man. He's so funny. He's a funny guy. You know, I've told the story before when he pranked me, you know.
Wait, I don't know if I know that.
We got time, right? You can go as long as you want.
I got time.
I'm doing fine. I'm enjoying it. Yeah. So
tell me the story. Tell us the story.
So Matt is a very funny guy. And I got to know him pretty decently when he first came to the CX. I did this big story on him and his family, a lot of the work he was doing charitably, you know, going to some really, really rugged places around the globe to administer, support and medical help and all this kind of stuff. And so he had this cool background. So I got to know him, and I was kind of lucky early on. One time I was on a flight coming into Seattle, and this couple had asked if I could move seats so that they could sit together. And I said, sure, you know. And then when I got down to baggage claim, I realized that was Don and Betsy Hasselbeck. And because Matt was there to greet him, and I was like, oh yeah. And they're like, oh, this fine young man here. I was young then. He gave us our seat. So I kind of like had this good, I always felt like I had this great start with Matt. And Lucky there at the baggage claim. So we had known each other. And it was in the very early days of text messages. I had, remember you had those old Nokia phones or whatever?
Uh-huh.
So at one point, you know, it was not common to really text people that much then. Like,
in the ass, I wouldn't, yeah.
Yeah, you know, it wasn't that common. So one day after Holmgren had been, his tenure had come under some fire, and there was some question over whether he was going to return or lose his title or something. And I was, it was a spring day, and I was getting ready to go to take the kids to the zoo. You know, my boys that are 24 and 21 now, we're going to go in a stroller basically. And at that time I was way engrossed in the beat, and it was always interrupting us when we wanted to go do something. And part of that was me, because I couldn't
put it down. I can only imagine.
Yeah, I can only imagine. So anyway, we got the kids all loaded up. We're going to go to the zoo. I get this text message from Hasselbeck, and it says Holmgren out. And I hadn't gotten many texts, you know, for Matt or anything. But I thought, oh my gosh. I mean, and we dropped everything. My wife's heart sank, you know, it was like, here we go again. There's always some news story that, you know, takes away that one day you're going to take off or whatever. And so I scrambled, and I actually called one of the coaches that I knew, and I got him like on a soccer field, his kid's soccer game or something. I'm like, hey, did you hear Holmgren's out or whatever? And he starts panicking. Like 3 minutes go by, and I get an April Fool's text from Matt. You know, and he probably knew me, my personality, you know, that I'm going to take this earnestly, like, you know, and in that day you didn't have some outlet. I wasn't going to like tweet it or something, you know, there was no way it was going to burn me, but I, you know, I got mildly embarrassed, and I had to call back somebody. There was probably some calls going through the staff at that point, you know, and it was great. It was just so perfect Hasselbeck.
Oh, you deserved it.
I deserved it completely, because I'm a prankster.
I'm going to tell you why. With Hasselbeck particularly. Can I tell this story? Do we have time here?
I don't even know what it is.
I'm good.
Okay. Sando. Well, first of all, Hasselbeck, unbelievable paying attention to the people who are in that world, including reporters. Unprecedented. No one like him. One time, you know, during playoffs, I can't remember what it was, late in the year when a lot of the visiting media comes in, and the normal media room is overflowing. And Matt came in, this was at the old Kirkland headquarters, with some guy who was, I don't know if it was an agent or a friend or whatever. He used to have to walk from the front door to the PR department. You kind of walk through the media room. And we were all in there, and Matt comes in, and I don't know who he's with, but he stopped and said, "Oh, here's our media." And I don't know, there was maybe 9 or 10 guys there. And Matt introduced this person to each reporter, writer, radio person, and correctly identified their media affiliation. Unbelievable. Every one of them, he could say who this is and who they work for. It was an amazing display of a guy who really gets it and has a sense of humanity. A good guy.
He's one of the all-time best.
So I don't know if it was an early thing on a video on the team website. Matt was doing some of that stuff. And Brian O'Connell was with him, helping him out. And Brian came in, and Mike and I were sitting there doing our work, and Mike was going to be leaving. And Brian said, "Hey, Matt's going to come through. We're going to do little video things with the media guys. That's, you know, it'll be kind of cool. It'll give the viewers a chance to see who these people are behind the stories." And Matt says, Mike says, "I got to go." And okay. And he says, "You know what you ought to do? It'll be hilarious. Matt will think it's great fun." Do you remember this?
I don't.
You should act like you're one of the football players who doesn't like to talk to the media, you know, who's real brusque with us and who's a smart ass and doesn't want to cooperate, you know. Matt will, this will be hilarious. And I go, "Oh, yeah, that is funny. That'll be good." So Matt comes in, nicest human in the face of the earth. And I'm like, "No, I don't talk to media guys." So they got, Brian is taking the film, and Matt's, you know, "Hey, well, this is, you know, on the table, and he works with so-and-so, and, you know." And tell me, Dave, you know, what about you have a favorite quarterback or something? And so I gave a smart ass remark, you know, and I was kidding him about why he's always wearing a ball cap. And he's looking at me like, where did this jerk come from? What is wrong with this guy? And I look out the windows there to the parking lot, and Mike is there.
Really?
I don't remember you, this at all. You punked the hell out of me. It was terrible. And here I admire this guy. I love working with this guy. And he's thinking, that bowling, God, what a jerk.
I did some bad ones.
Hey. It was really rude. And, you know, and the other I never one mentioned that I, it to Matt, but I know I asked Brian afterward. I said, oh, I was just kidding with him. He said, we couldn't use any of that.
Oh, my. That's so bad. You know, the worst one, the funniest one that I thought was when Holmgren was new and we never got to talk to him, and he came out to the draft after that first round of the draft or whatever. First draft was over. He came out to talk to us. And so I told Claire and Dave Bowling and all these guys, I said, hey, when Holmgren comes out, let's all joke with him and hold up a sign with an F for our grade. Right. Except I made mine an A. And everyone else did F.
All of us were holding up F's and Mike was A plus or something.
And I hold up an A, teacher's pet, you know, getting on Holmgren's good side. All these guys had F's. And I thought it was the funniest thing. And no one else, Dave didn't think it was as funny as I did. I thought it was very funny.
I didn't know you were an asshole, Mike. Like this is a whole new side of you.
Well, I'm the oldest brother in the family, and Dave's the youngest in the family. So Dave has a real sensitivity to being pranked and all this stuff, even though he's a big tough guy. He has sensitivity to that. And I was the guy who thought it was funny to play all the pranks. And God, there was another one too.
You've treated us to a number of good ones, and
if you don't need any more, yeah.
We'll get back together next week, have more of these moments, and we'll be able to talk about a game, a divisional game for the Seahawks. We'll find out who that's going to be. And by the way, next week's going to be big. Going to have Mina Kimes on the show. Going to have Brian Baldinger on the show. Brett Coleman, you guys, a whole list of great guests. Thanks for starting Blue Friday off the right way. Dave Bowling of the Spokesman Review, Mike Sando of The Athletic. Guys, have a great weekend.
Thank you.
All right. That is Dave Bowling and Mike Sando. And I mean, what a treat to have those guys. It's just such a treat. And smart, articulate historians, like know everything that's happened in the game and around the game. Love each other, which certainly helps as they I don't think I've ever seen Mike smile as much as when he's with Mr. Bowling and the way those two tease each other. So really, really special to have that opportunity to catch up with those guys, and a lot of great stuff in there. I love that Dave brought up the screen game, you know, on his own. And Dave is a student, like not only played the sport, but, you know, just always for me was a guy I'd want to see what he said about the line play for the Seahawks when he was covering the team for the Tacoma News Tribune. And I have a high respect for his ability to evaluate offensive line, especially, but also defensive line play. And he's noticing that they're using Gray Zabel and Jalen Sundell's athleticism in ways that maybe really wasn't showcased as much. And it's not an accident necessarily that Gray Zabel just had the highest graded game, I think, of any rookie this season by PFF in its game against San Francisco. So yeah, like a lot of really, really good stuff in there. We've got some super chats. We'll get to those. Also have some stats I wanted to share, a couple small stats, and we'll get you guys all on your way. I'm going to be heading over to the Simply Seattle warehouse to grab some new Seahawks gear. I highly recommend, if you haven't already, do the same thing. Go not to the warehouse, but go to simplyseattle.com. Use code HawkBlogger15. That will get you 15% off your favorite Seahawks gear, Mariners gear, Huskies, whatever it is. Maybe not a Damon Williams jersey. I don't know. But in any event, use code HawkBlogger15. Get your favorite gear there and get 15% off. So take advantage while you can. Also, head over to grab the Sleeper app if you haven't already. Download it now. Use promo code HAWK. Get up to $100 match on your first deposit. Terms and conditions do apply. So see Sleeper's terms of use for details. Currently operational over 25 states. Check out Sleeper today. And if you haven't been getting a good night's sleep, you know, worried, excited, whatever it is, I've got something that's going to help. Check this out. I love my Manta Sleep Mask. It's a huge game changer. Highly recommend you check it out. And as we get into super chats here, I also want to acknowledge that we've got a celebrity in chat as usual. Stan Darnold, who's having his moment in the sun, is very exciting for a fellow, his ginger brother, as I think Sam Darnold was watching a video of Stan Darnold, Super Sauce XL in chat. And that was really funny. It was great stuff. And represented 12s well, like articulate, well-spoken, friendly. Good job, man. Love to see in that. And I'm glad the Seahawks, I was giving them some ideas of how to get in touch, because I think Sam was hoping that would happen. So very cool. Love that we're getting a little, you know, celebrity status in chat. Never hurts to do that. Let's talk about some of these super chats. Francisco Gonzalez says, morning, Brian. Any update on if the Seahawks have suffered any side effects from playing the 49ers and there is an injury-causing electrical substation? That is fantastic. Fantastic, Francisco. I love the joke. For people that don't know, there was some conspiracy theorist that was out there saying that because there's an electrical substation next to the 49ers practice facility, that it's weakened their tendons and other things and caused problems, and doctors have come out to actually say the inverse tends to be true. It can actually stimulate cell growth. And anyway, absolute bizarro stuff. And in this day and age where, you know, some people decide that science does not matter, you know, all sorts of theories get thrown around. All I know is Jeff Simmons, I think, nailed it. It does tend to happen when you're old that you get injured more. I can attest to that. It's just a reality. And when you've been injured before, your likelihood is more likely you're going to get injured again. And the 49ers have old players and injury prone players. And it's not a shock that they're having the problems that they are having. Italian Knight, generous as usual, donating 50 free Hawk Blogger memberships to the YouTube channel. Really, really appreciate it, Mr. Knight. And hopefully if you guys get one of these free memberships, you pay it forward, give somebody else a free membership, upgrade your membership to a club level membership where you get access to the Discord server, hang out with all of us, which is a growing and great friendly community over there. And also, if you go to patreon.com/hawkblogger, you can sign up there, get access to the Discord server, get ad-free audio for this show, and get verified over at hbtix.com. HBTix, no fees, place to go. There are playoff tickets up there right now. Buy them today. Buy them today, because as soon as tomorrow, if the Packers win, Packers fans will start buying those tickets. They will. And they will spend more than what Seahawks fans will, because Seahawks fans feel like it's the home team and they can get access to tickets more easily. Packers fans know that they're going to have to pay whatever the price is. The prices are going to probably go up once the other team knows who's playing. Buy them today. Buy your playoff tickets today. Get it done. All right. Next, OEL says, I don't know if you can take much stock in the Perna Kirsch wheel, but it's hilarious that it landed on the Rams. Watch Bryce Young turn into Steve Young. Well, there's a little bit of news there. The Rams, Kevin Dotson, their right guard, who was injured in the Seahawks game, not by Derek Hall, is not going to play against the Panthers. And Robert Hunt, the all-pro right guard for the Panthers, is going to play for the Panthers. Now, I still don't know that that's going to be enough. There's also supposedly maybe a little bit of weather, a little bit of rain potentially for this game, a little thunderstorm, lightning storm. So, who knows? Like, I would love the Panthers to give them everything they can. I'd love it to not be a blowout. It probably will be a blowout, but you know what? it'd be fun. Let's see what we can get. The North Bend House says, I feel like we have our own Vic Fangio, but ours is able to be a great head coach as well. It's a great way to think about it. Vic Fangio, who is maybe the best defensive mind in football. I know when I talked to Richard Sherman back in 2011, when he was first coming out in 2012 as well, that he held Vic Fangio in such high regard. That was back when he was at Stanford. And just said, I mean, he eventually came to the 49ers with Harbaugh, but that he was the smartest defensive mind he'd ever come into contact with. And yeah, he's really, really good. He did not survive as a head coach, unlike Mr. McDonald. So great point there. Old School Seahawk, OSS, who's been a member for a year and a half. Thank you for that. Says Blue Friday with Brian, Mike, and Dave is the best. Thank you. Well, I'm glad you enjoy it. I certainly do as well. Let me check Venmo Super Chats. Venmo.com/Brian-Nemhauser is the way you leave these. I had somebody ask, like, hey, I don't see how to do a Super Chat on Venmo. There's not a specific Super Chat feature. Just leave, you know, make a contribution and leave a comment, and I will read that comment as a super chat. So there you go. First, Garrick Danielson gave a contribution for HB Tix. Says HB Tix reimbursement never used, but love the idea. That's really kind of you. I really appreciate it. As you guys know, it's all coming out of my pocket. I don't make any money off of HB Tix. I do pay for it to be run up there on the server. So I appreciate you helping to defray some of those costs. It's a way to be helping the community. All right. Joey Hamilton with a super chat says, every time I watch a Hawks press conference, I like these guys even more. Also appreciate your questions and how you phrase them to the players without leading them into a canned answer. It's a more genuine vibe. Can you speak to your press conference strategy and prep? Well, that is really nice of you, Joey. So quickly, I will say that I've always been someone who's kind of comfortable speaking, you know, speaking up in meetings, didn't matter who it's with, like CEOs, board members, press members, whatever. Like it's not something that I get stage fright. The problem is that it also makes me a little bit overconfident, or at least it did when I first started getting when I got credentialed last year and asked some dumb questions the first time to Mike McDonald, and actually had sleepless nights that first night after I, you know, asked some dumb questions. And I was like, all right, I need to be more intentional about this. And so I have a list of every kind of major person that gets up there regularly. And I'm constantly, if I'm taking a walk, if it's throughout the day, if something occurs to me, I just add topics to it, questions to it. And sometimes they sit on the lists for months because I not only am deciding whether or not to ask, like if that person's going to the right time to ask them, but I want to make sure it's like the right moment. Some of them are high level, some of them are personal, you know, so I try to read the situation a little bit about when's the right time to ask some of those. But I try to generally, like most of the questions are just things that occur to me, like 99%. And my general rule, I've talked to this about this with actually with Mike McDonald over the offseason. We're talking about just different press folks and his different experiences. But I have three rules that I try to have, not three rules, but three criteria to determine if a question I ask is successful. The first is, do you learn something about the person? Do you learn something? The second one is, do you learn something about football? And the third one is, does it have the potential to get people more engaged, excited about the Seahawks? And it is intentional on that third one to have something that is generally positively slanted. And I found that those three are useful. It doesn't have to be that all three are the case, but if at least one of the answers to those questions is yes, then I consider it successful. So I'm definitely trying to learn about, help us learn about football, help us learn about the people, and then help learn things that might get us a little more enthusiastic. Like an example of that might be, you know, my questions lately about when does it get personal for a player? Like, teams talk about rivalries all the time. When does it get personal for you? It tells you a little bit about the person, but it also, I think, can get, you know, a little bit of stuff for fans to get excited about when the players are more bought in. So that's kind of how I approach it. I think we got one more super chat over here while I was talking, which I'm always talking. Alex, the 12th man, says, who do you think will be the players we don't re-sign that we will have, that will have the biggest impact on our team? I mean, I'm going to try to have Brady Henderson on next week. I think that's a good question to talk through with him, because Brady's been pretty steadfast in thinking that they were not going to re-sign Tariq Woolen. That would be my first answer. If they don't re-sign him, I think that's going to be a big impact. I think he does a lot more for this team than people realize. I think he's playing some of his best football right now, honestly, since his rookie year. I think he is. There's a play in this 49ers game, fourth down, where he broke on the ball, passed to Kyle Juszczyk, nearly picked it off. He's just, he's playing really, really good football. So that would be my major answer there. Kobe Bryant's a sneaky one. I think there's a pretty good chance they will not re-sign him right now, because Ty Okada has really stepped forward, and they already have Nicky Minwori and they have Julian Love. So maybe they don't spend on a free agent safety. But Julian Love and others have talked about how big of a leadership role Kobe Bryant plays and the kind of attitude he plays with. And he's also been a guy that has a knack for creating turnovers. So he's another guy that stands out to me as a potential impact if he were to leave. All right. So the last thing I wanted to share, oops, got another super chat. Italian Knights says, which Super Bowl rematch do you want most? Steelers, Broncos, Patriots? For me, the Broncos probably. I think I have the most animosity for Broncos fans and would like to put them back. I also don't like Sean Payton, so like I wouldn't enjoy that. But I also wouldn't mind, I mean, any of them are fine, to be honest, but it'd be nice to beat the Patriots, the team that beat the Seahawks in the Super Bowl. So that would be good too. I could take that. All right. So here is a stat that I wanted to share with you guys. I was looking at this up today, and if you know what success rate is, if you don't, let me explain it. Success rate is, there's different ways to measure it, but the old school way to measure it is getting, you know, I think it's like 40% of the yards you need on first down, 60% of the yards you need on second down, and 100% of the yards you need on third down. So a good success rate is maybe 40%, you know, 42% is a pretty good success rate, 45, 50 gets really good. And so there's this notion of what's your success rate on offense. And then net success rate is your success rate on offense minus your opponent's success rate. So were you more successful on offense than they were? It's a good kind of way to get an overall feel of whether throughout the course of a game, you were the better team because you were on average more successful with your plays than they were. The Seahawks had a positive net success rate in 16 of their 17 games. In fact, the only time they didn't was very small against the 49ers in week one. And what that means is they've had 16 straight positive success rate games, 16 in a row. No other team, I think, in the NFL has more than 14 positive success rate games on the year. And the other thing to note here is that two of those games were against the Rams. The Seahawks actually had a positive net success rate in both games against the Rams, had a higher one in the first game, the one that they lost, than they did in the second game. So I thought that was interesting. I have not created a visual on this one yet, but I will tell you this other one that I found that I think is pretty interesting. And we've talked about explosive rate for this team, but there's another one that's explosive differential, which is, did you have more explosive plays on offense than your opponent? And again, I'm still just using the same explosive play definition that Pete Carroll did, which is 12 plus yards for a run, 16 plus yards for a pass. a little different than the standard 10 and 20, depending on where you look at it. But in any event, just so you know the numbers. But I use it for both teams, so it's apples to apples. The Seahawks had a negative explosive play differential twice in their first eight games and three times in their first nine games. Since then, they have not had a single negative explosive differential game, meaning that they have either been tied or had more explosive plays than the team that they were facing. That includes a game against the Rams, but includes both games against the Rams, as a matter of fact. And not only that, but I go by quartile of the season. So, you know, quarters of the season. So the first four games of the season, if you add up like the sum of all the explosive play differentials. So let's say the first game against the 49ers was a negative one. The 49ers had one more explosive play than the Seahawks. Okay. So that's a negative one. The game against the Steelers, the Seahawks had a plus seven, meaning they had seven more. So you add those two things together, that's six, right? So you, the first four games total explosive play differential was 13. Okay. So plus 13. That's really good. Their next four games, plus six. So less than half, not as good. The four games after that, even worse, plus three. So you were seeing this decline in terms of, it's not just an offensive evaluation, it's defense giving up explosives as well, right? There was this decline in explosive play differential. Well, over the last five games of the season, the Seahawks had a plus 21 explosive play differential. That is the best of any period of time during this season. So even if their explosive play rate on offense is not quite what it was to start the year, I've already reported how it's climbed back to better than it had been at its low. But the combination of how the Seahawks are playing on defense and limiting explosives and how they're playing on offense, getting more explosives, has led them to this massive differential in explosive plays. I think this is not a story that has been covered. I think it's a very important one. Explosives are how you score points or how you limit opponents from scoring points. It's a huge correlation with scoring. So this is a big one. And I think pretty interesting, at least to me. So I wanted to share all that with you guys before we head out. Another long show today, but it was worth it. Hopefully you enjoyed it. There's no team stuff going on today. There'll be no team stuff going on till next week. So I will be back with you tomorrow with Jeff Simmons for Seahawks Saturday. Then we'll have a fun time watching Wildcard Weekend. Sunday, I don't have plans yet. I might try to see if I can convince Rob and Griff to come back for a show. We'll see what their availability is. But until then, folks, have a great rest of your Friday. Give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcast. Always appreciate that. Or Spotify, wherever you listen. Head over to patreon.com/hawkblogger. Join the family for this stretch run. And we'll see you all tomorrow. Until then, take care.